You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Music, right? Never a good thing. Woody's being elusive.
You've reached Colonel Chris Woodbridge, editor of the Marine Corps Gazette. I can't take your call right now. To leave a message for me, please call 703-640-0180. 703-640-0180. Thank you, and Semper Fidelis.
Woody, what are you doing?
Please speak louder.
Yeah, whatever. No, I just emailed him and said, what's going on? Yeah, there's a video of John Bazelon's little cross, USMC. Had some Eagle Globe and Anchor at the top, right? The white cross. And then down below the white, the Eagle Globe and Anchor is USMC vertically. And then on the cross, on the horizontal piece of the cross, Bazelon, John. Gunnery Sergeant, 287506 or Golf, one of the two. Probably six, as those numbers went. So we're waiting on Chris Woodbridge, who I'm emailing with, but for whatever reason, he's not answering his phone. Yeah, I don't know that maybe I've seen that image before and I just don't know it. There he is. Oh, is that a different number? Woodbridge, did you change your number?
Negative.
Oh, I can't.
Negative. I'm going to have to find out what's going on with that.
Yeah, you might be missing some important calls because I went to voicemail probably four times.
I wonder if they did. I was TAD last week, so I just got to make sure they didn't do something while I was gone.
I'm sure they did. They probably.
Gee, that's why it's been so peaceful.
I wondered why nobody was calling me for the last.
It's quiet out there, Mac. Too quiet.
Something's up. This is the calm before the storm. What the hell? First of all, February is always an incredible month on the Marine Corps calendar. The Tet Offensive, Khe Sanh, Hue, and Iwo Jima, to name a few of them. Pretty amazing month in Marine Corps history.
Yeah, without a doubt. And this year, you know, we've got some milestones there. You've got the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, which actually started this month, extended into March. You can't quite put a pin in the day that is most recognizable as the Tet Offensive. I mean, obviously the operations in Hue and Khe Sanh have a better defined start and end times, but 50 years this month, which is remarkable.
You know, let me ask you, when you hear Tet Offensive, what do you think of? I'm your psychiatrist, Woody. Okay, so you come in.
How does it make you feel?
Exactly. You come in with all your issues. I tell you, okay, don't take your meds for a week. Okay, so you roll in unmedicated, and I have my flashcards. And on one of the flashcards, it's not those spots. It says Tet Offensive, and I flash it in front of your face. What do you think?
Honestly, the first thing is the quote from Walter Cronkite that even he thinks the war was lost at that point. After the attacks in Saigon on the American embassy, the coordinated attacks at in Hue, at Khe Sanh, our established positions in Fubai, at Tonsonet Airport, and it was very clear within 24 to 48 hours, at least in the U.S. media, that this is a coordinated general offensive in the south of the country.
Okay, so that's what comes to mind when you see Tet Offensive. You know what's begin to come to mind? As the annihilation of the Viet Cong and the hammering of the North Vietnamese Army in spite of their tactical surprise. When I think of I think of that now. But you know what? They get annihilated. I mean, if you use the term destroy, the Viet Cong are destroyed.
They were no longer the Viet Cong as an insurgent force, both at the at the guerrilla and main force level were no longer effective after that point.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they were, you know, completely non-existent, but as a fighting force, they were effectively annihilated.
And the
NVA
is until what, 72?
Correct.
Until 72. I mean, that's a serious ass whooping. And again, it starts by counterpunching, but when you think about the numbers of the NVA and the VC that were killed and so I don't know.
The other thing that strikes me, and this is really specific to the Battle of Hue, is still somewhat in question. Factually and underreported, particularly in U.S. media and scholarship, are the number of South Vietnamese who were killed by the Viet Cong and NVA in the outset, the first 24 hours of that assault or that seizure of Way City.
South Vietnamese soldiers, civilians, or both?
No, civilians.
Right.
Civilians,
right. Wow.
Particularly any South Vietnamese associated either with the Republic of Vietnam government or with the local provincial government, city government, schools, and their families, and then certainly any South Vietnamese who were known or suspected to be working with the Americans. Again, a very, today we use terms like ethnic cleansing,
right.
But it is a very well-established tactic of communist insurgent forces that when an opportunity like that presents itself, you purge or otherwise remove those players from the problem. And it was underestimated and underreported at the time, and with the exception of some overseas Vietnamese, not folks in the country right now, it's largely been underestimated and forgotten.
A text message from a Vietnam veteran. In 68, no one in the United States was told the North Vietnamese got their asses kicked. In fact, it was the opposite.
Right.
Fucking press BS. Not that wound festers 50 years later.
No,
but it does.
But, and up to and including, the talking heads of the day, like Cronkite, et cetera, that essentially, you got to wonder, and I'm not that much of a conspiracy theorist, but clearly at that time, much of the media was looking for an excuse to call the war lost. They had in some cases never agreed with the approach to the war,
right.
When you overlay that a few years later with the discovery of the Pentagon Papers, that now we have all new Hollywood movies about, you've got to understand an information environment that was spring-loaded against the effort in the war.
I was driving, I live in...
All my personal opinions, by the way.
It's all right. We love that. I live in Orange County, in Newport Beach, Costa Mesa, in proximity to the Orange County Fairgrounds. So my daughter, 14-year-old daughter, Colleen and I are driving. And now everybody else is out of the house, so Colleen gets the benefit of all my tutoring and lecturing these days. So we're driving, and there's this big billboard that says AVA Tet Festival. And I see the words Tet on this big billboard, and now my truck starts swerving. Colleen's like, Dad, what's going on? I'm like, Ted, God damn it, Colleen. She's like, what? And I said,
Easy now.
Exactly. I said, no.
Take a deep breath.
I said, people live across the street from us are Vietnamese, and big Vietnamese community here in the area. And I said, that's a lunar holiday, the New Year. In fact, there's a huge battle fought in Vietnam in which we annihilated the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong. She looks at me, she says, okay. But I'm reading, in the Vietnam, PBS series, done by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, the blonde-haired Vietnamese guy, who's one of the coolest dudes in that gets interviewed, that he's an NVA soldier. His name is Bao Ninh, and he's written a book called The Sorrow of War.
Phenomenal book called The Sorrow of War.
Have you read it?
Absolutely.
Oh, shit, man. You talk about a bleak existence. Can you imagine being in, your battalion of the 500 people that leave, you're one of the 10 that survive. And then when you get your numbers bled down, you go to an R&R camp in which the political officers, they get up and tell you that you're winning the war, the harvest up north is great, you're reading letters from your family telling you that you're starving to death, and you know you're mm-hmm. gonna go back south and face the American firepower. And he talks about what it's like to be caught in the inferno of American fire. And you look at that from that perspective and you're like, wow. Wow. And you don't hear him talk about, well, when my enlistment, you know, runs out, I'm not going to reenlist. Yeah. You don't hear that. You're in for the duration once you signed up.
That's exactly right. There is no reenlistment.
Yeah.
Again, a very, very different construct. And, you know, in some ways, bleak as that existence was, you know, the optimal tool for the job, in some cases were the, not necessarily the urban, North Korean, youth as soldiers, but those who were from the farmland, rural areas, the countryside, and even up into, the low highlands, just being inured to that existence to begin with. And so the level of privation is not much higher than what they experienced in their, you know, in their growing up lives. What I always found remarkable, and I've been to Vietnam three times, there is among those veterans that I've seen, met and talked with, no, acrimony, no, hatred of America. It's really pretty interesting. And especially in younger Vietnamese, I don't want to say, you know, the equivalent of the baby boom or Gen
right,
X,
right.
Generation of Vietnamese people. Absolutely no bad feelings, acrimony towards the U.S. Very much a, in the much younger Vietnamese, almost a, misinformation that you know the Americans kind of almost won the war because there is so much foreign investment and business in what was Saigon and South Vietnam that you know they look at pictures of Singapore, look at pictures of Hong Kong, look at pictures of Los Angeles and see a lot of the same businesses there. There's almost a view that our governments got involved in this thing a long time ago, and it wasn't any individual's decision to go to this level of violence. And you know now that it's over, we can really be friends. They see great opportunities in working with the U.S. especially on the military to military side.
You know what's interesting is you know the Chinese have that that mm-hmm. what is it that nine dash line,
right?
That it would be the equivalent of us plopping our asses down on let's say off the coast of Argentina, and because it's about 900 miles south of Hong Kong, and then drawing a line down the coast of Mexico through Central America. And off Argentina and Chile and saying, yeah, this is now ours. Like, what?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
This is an actually one of the least studied and, in some ways most, informative, wars, to have occurred, in the mid 1970s was the war between a unified Vietnam at that point, and the People's Republic of China. It was fought in the jungle borderland between North Vietnam and what is the southern provinces of China, Yunnan, and the mighty People's Liberation Army, which had from the 1940s on dominated both the politics and culture of China, and served as a yardstick for what light infantry could do, was soundly defeated by the Vietnamese, partially because they were untrained in that jungle environment, and partially because they had evolved past the type of People's Liberation Army infantrymen who, for example, the Marine Corps faced at Chosin Reservoir. They had, in some ways, evolved to the point where they were less inured to that kind of physical hardship in combat, and their tactics also suffered in that their training had become more focused on political indoctrination during the Great Cultural Revolution than on actually learning the tactics of small unit combat. So very interesting study, not a lot written on it in English, but there are some great books and great studies about it out there.
Interesting.
So from the not to interrupt, but from the modern perspective, yes, that line that you describe, right, and the Vietnamese view of being open to partnership with the U.S. is in their strategic interest to keep the real enemy at bay, and the real enemy of Vietnam in their worldview is and has always been China.
You know, what's interesting is that it's a similar conclusion that was reached in Al Anbar, and that is, look, the Americans will go away. ISIS never will. And when you, you know, in what, 2007, 2008, when at the beginning of the awakening, when, you know, the sheikhs and the principal landlords of Al Anbar got together and said, you know what, we need to throw in with the Americans because we can have a relationship with the Americans, right? Look at what they do historically. Look at what they do around the world. We can't have a relationship with ISIS. They will either own us and kill us. And so it's an interesting perspective. Chris Woodbridge, our guest.
That's exactly right.
Chris Woodbridge, our guest. And I think what's going on in the South China Sea is the biggest joke. China is a gangster nation. You know, let's create economic ties. Let me get you hooked on crack cocaine. Once I get you manufacturing and exporting to China, then I'll use that to extort technology from you. All in exchange, if you don't want your economy to go sideways and you don't want me to shut off this big market to you, then you better play my game. And then, you know, and you're watching the Philippines dance to their song now. You know, the Scarborough Shoals, are you kidding me? You know, the next thing they're going to take over is in Manila Harbor. You know, it's a joke how close they are to the Philippines, claiming that it's Chinese sovereign land. And the United States is being provocative by sailing within 12 nautical miles of this shit. It's just amazing. And so, you know, but again, we're one day closer to a day when the Chinese people rise up and throw their asses out. It may be a while, but it's going to happen. The same thing with Russia and that gangster idiot. Those are just my personal opinions, Woody. Before we talk about the February issue, I emailed Woody yesterday, and one of the great benefits of the Gazette, and this is a no-shitter, is that when you're doing research, or just when something comes up, if you go into their archives, for instance, and just do a search on Hue, or Tet, or Quezon, or Iwo Jima, right, you are going to get articles that are written within weeks of, months of, the event happening, with pronouns I, he, we, not they. And it's all aspects. It's logistics. It's combat operations. It's aviation. It's command and control. It's what the Gazette has been to the Marine Corps. It's intellectual lifeblood for its existence. And I asked Woody to go in and find the three articles, one about each one. I'm not sure he completed his task, so he's getting ready to go into the bus right here. Woody, first of all, comment about your archives, and then hopefully you completed your task.
I more than completed the task.
Nice.
I exceeded the standard as usual. Second piece, the archives really are a a unique benefit of membership in the Professional Association of Marines. On the Gazette side, our archives go back to 1916, with the very first article, the very first edition of the magazine. It's all searchable. You can search by an edition, a month and year number. If you know it, you can search by author. You can search by subject. It is, by and large, restricted to members of the association. Frankly, I put that in the category of not giving away the milk.
Right.
But there are portions of it that I will open up to anyone to search on. As an example, those who are doing any sort of study or research of maneuver warfare and its development as our warfighting philosophy, there is a maneuver warfare collection of basically all the Gazette articles published between the late 70s and the present on that subject that anyone, any Marine, any scholar or reader can get to on the Gazette homepage. At various points, we've considered taking certain pieces that are particularly relevant at that time. For example, with the anniversary of the landings on Iwo Jima, we're going to put a couple of articles from the archive on Iwo Jima outward facing on the website for anyone to access and look at here over the next week or so.
There is an article that I saw and I read, where the hell do I have it? I have this Iwo Jima collection that when I die, my
17 days at Iwo Jima.
No, I want to say it's about Hill 362 Alpha that they, and if you know anything about the battle, it is on the west side of the island, and it's kind of between the coastline and the center plateau, if you will, which means there's kind of an amphitheater around it on three sides and the water on the other side. This amphitheater is full of apertures that protect it. And then 362 Alpha is its own honeycombed fortress in and of itself. And there's a pencil drawing, there's a sketch drawing. And when you read about it, the fight over 362 Alpha, it's really confusing. And this is before there was Google Earth. You had to rely on the maps the authors gave you, you know. And you're looking at it going, I don't get it, man. It's like every time I read something, they're surrounded. You know, how the hell? How did, bigger than a breadbasket, you know, smaller than a Volkswagen. And the article, and I'm looking for it right now, in the McNamara archives, is amazing in terms of its clarity, and it's written by a dude that was in the middle of it. So anyway, so go ahead. What do you got from Iwo Jima?
So from Iwo Jima, what you'll actually see this week and next, got an article out of the archives. It was actually written in 2001. And its title is Our Flags Unfurled. That article is a study and an acknowledgement of both flag raisings. It's very much, everyone obviously is familiar with the Rosenthal image and the Iwo Jima Marine Corps War Memorial and those images, but this is a comprehensive look at both flag raisings. The other one I'll point out, and this is much more recent, really just from August of 16, we had, if you recall, a Marine Corps commission that was impaneled to look at new evidence regarding the identities of the flag raisers.
Mm-hmm.
That article is entitled 70 Years Later Was a Mistake Made. And that's actually, again, in the February of 16 Gazette. Goes through the entire forensics of the decision to really change history.
I was thinking about that the other day, and it would, you know, that image for this organization, it's like somebody telling a Catholic, like, yeah, in the painting, The Last Supper, see the guy next to Jesus? That's really he's the fish salesman, like from across the street. He just showed up for dinner. Like, what? Are you kidding me? How could this be? And just to think all those, you know, and I was thinking about this, you know, a name that you don't see prominently mentioned anymore. When, you know, we get around to the days which the landing occurs and on the 23rd is, you don't see John Bradley's name mentioned, very much. And I mean the son of, and, you know, and so that whole story is very interesting.
You know, it's unfortunate that, the evidence, really pretty clearly indicates that, that Doc Bradley was not one of the second flag raisers.
Right.
But did participate, in the first flag raising.
Right.
And I think the overall message, Mac, is none of this should, in any way take away from the sacrifice of the men who were on that island and the legacy of that battle.
No, and I will tell you even more. I think it's a more interesting book because, and I wish your son would write it. I should probably have him on the program if he would do it. But he knows that's not him because the uniform that he wore on a daily basis on Iwo Jima, you and I have talked about this before, is not even close to what the dude in the picture is wearing. Or in the statue is worn. So he knows that, and yet he doesn't. He's not going to disturb it. He went and he on the war bond drive. And so to me, it would be such an interesting, you know, if you could talk to him about what did you live with, why did you do that, you know, in terms of, you know, the way you live with the trauma that you experience. I mean, he's a Navy Cross winner. He's not apologizing to anybody. But to me, that is just so Bradley knows that every time that phone rings and somebody wants to talk to him about that picture, he knows that he's not in that picture. And there's no doubt in my mind that he knows it. And that's why when you see his picture at the dedication of it, it looks like somebody, you know, stuffed a grapefruit up his ass. I mean, he doesn't look like he's a happy guy that day in any of the pictures that you see there. So I just – and I lament that his son has gone somewhat silent over him. You don't see him interviewed very often anymore.
Exactly.
It's almost like he feels embarrassed when he shouldn't. That's another
– No, that's exactly right.
That's another part of this story is his dad essentially taking one for the team, you know?
That's exactly right. And you know, essentially, going along with things,
right.
Even though, you know, he couldn't be entirely sure, you know, sure that he was there for a flag raising, but you know, after that, you know, we all know that getting wounded can definitely, affect the short-term memory and not being able to quite keep it straight.
Yeah, you're being gracious. That guy wore leggings.
Well,
every,
but also not wanting to disrupt the war.
Right, exactly. And then after that, this image rises to mythological proportions. And now I'm going to put my hand up, old Doc Bradley, after I've done all that, and say, you know what? I need to come clean with everybody. That's not me. And then bring all that attention on yourself. You know, better let sleeping dogs lie.
And well, you're right, and the other piece to it is again very very hard for us to you know really conceptualize, but the number of killed, the number of casualties, and what the guys who made it home carried with them, and you look at a signature aspect of that generation of getting on with things. And doing what's best for the collective interest, vice their own self-interest, just the unselfishness of that generation to kind of carry the burdens of the survivor and not make waves and not create a lot of fanfare and not create a lot of self-promoting heroism or self-promoting victimhood, you know, is a signature of that that greatest generation. And I think you've got to recognize and respect that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, John Bradley, a Navy Cross winner, and how those guys are right in the head. You know, when explaining what a corpsman is to civilians, you say, well, they're kind of like our EMTs, but they're not. They don't treat people they don't know. The guys that are gurgling their last breaths, right, are their friends. They're close, close personal friends who they're with in their last moments, whose bodies are shattered. And that's the difference. Mm-hmm. How those people are ever right in the head, and I'm not sure they are, is a miracle, is an absolute miracle, because their job is the most difficult job on the battlefield. You know, that is absolutely brutal. And to do it in a place like Iwo Jima, crazy. Let me tell you what I've dug out of the Marine Corps Gazette and Leatherneck over the years. First Jap prisoner captured on Iwo Jima by Lou Lowry in Leatherneck. Then I have saved I saved my search. I copied and pasted my search. First 6 days on Iwo Jima, Marine Corps Gazette. Next one. Memories of a tank gunner on Iwo Jima, which is outstanding, by the way. Let's see. Next one is Japanese defense of Iwo Jima. You can find that. That's by the Japanese intelligence officer that was captured. His name is Hori. That was published in the Gazette. A narrative of Iwo Jima from a battleship off the coast. That's in the Gazette. 10 days on Iwo Jima, Leatherneck, U.S., let's see.
Still there, Mac?
I am.
Okay.
I'm just scrolling through my stuff. So that gives you some idea of just a few of the things that I pulled out of eyewitness accounts of that battle. So give me the article that you would tell people to read.
The article I wouldn't?
You would. I'm sorry.
Oh, I would. No, there's a additional article on Iwo Jima. It's 17 days on
okay.
Iwo Jima, and the author is a Merritt E. Benson. Not to be confused with Merritt Edson,
right.
But Merritt E. Benson. It was not. It wasn't published until much later. So it's a
right.
It's more of a scholarly work, but it uses source material from participants and even from some of those articles that you'd mentioned.
Yeah, it's. Let me tell you, it's a virtual treasure trove when you're doing research. All right, give me one from Wei. Same thing. It's very cool.
So the one from Wei is for a number of reasons in my book the must read from Wei, and that's originally published in April of '77, republished in our 100th anniversary issue in March of '16. By then, Major Ron Christmas, a company commander, remembers the battle for Wei. I think most of us of a certain age and generation have known in one way or another Lieutenant General Christmas, now retired,
right.
And
right.
Know something about his action as a company commander under then Lieutenant Colonel Ernie Cheatham. In the Battle of Wei, this is a first-hand account from him. Again, a little bit removed, 9 years from the action, but very, very fresh insight, first-person account.
Right. And again, he's still yet a major, and Vietnam is still something we really don't talk about. So he's writing this for what? The audience would be his peers in the Marine Corps Gazette, yes? In a professional
yes,
journal?
And also at the time he had, after being wounded, he had served as almost immediately on the staff of the old AWS, Amphibious
right.
Warfare
right.
School.
Right.
And so I think some of it is, again, fighting for that audience, for right. the officers coming behind him who need that learning.
Right, and I'm sure he got hit up for that, you know. I've heard Zinni talk about it. You know, I'm always getting hit up for my combat experiences because we weren't fighting a whole lot after that. And so, you know, young officers saying, well, what was it like? And you should write something about it. I'm sure he got on a regular basis. All right, so that's Hue. What about Kaesong?
Kaesong. Okay, I've got a few selections for you here. Because, again, it kind of covers the MagTaf waterfront from May of 1969. So again, think about the timing here.
Right.
Helicopter operations at Kaesong. Author's name is Barry Nelson, and it's based on a series of interviews with pilots who were flying in and out of Kaesong. We sort of tend to think about the C-130s. And their role in sustaining the forces on the ground at that battle, helicopters were a big part of that as well. From April of 73, so again, just within 5 years, title of the article is Siege, 40 Days at Kaesong, and the author is Mark A. Swearingen. Once again, comprehensive study based on first-hand accounts. And then the last one that I'll recommend on Kaesong was not published until February of 89. On an anniversary, a 20-year anniversary, give or take. And this is Kaesong Attack on Hill 861 Alpha by Eric Hamill. And that is really just a series of interviews, accounts of Marines who participated in the battle. That's just tip of the iceberg, quite honestly. I purely looked in
It's designed to be a teaser, okay? Just the goal.
I only looked
the goal.
In the Gazette archives.
Right. Oh.
So I only looked in the Gazette archives.
Okay, that's fine.
If you look over and expand the search over into Leathernecks archives, remember that from World War II up through the early 1970s in Vietnam, the staff of Leatherneck included Marines, active Marines,
combat correspondents,
and combat cameramen. So, you know, Lou Lowry was on the staff of Leatherneck magazine.
Right.
That's very important. That changed in the mid-70s because of a change in law and DOD policy. But the Marines who we, you know today as our combat cameramen and our public affairs Marines, there were a group of them that were assigned as the staff of the Leatherneck magazine. And they would be working here around Quantico, but also out in the field, deployed to these various units to augment the unit combat correspondence. On the Leatherneck side, you're gonna see so much what I call a human history of these great historic battles. But get the individual Marine perspective of that is really, particularly when you look at the World War II, Korea, Vietnam vintage magazines, Leatherneck magazines from the archive. It's pretty remarkable stuff. Very fresh and definitely first person, first hand accounts.
It's awesome stuff. All right. Thank you for completing that task. Well done, my friend.
That's my homework assignment.
There you go. But again,
I get an A minus.
No, you got a straight up A. What do you mean? I'll take the minus off because of the phone situation because it wasn't your fault. Just to pitch to everybody, if you enjoy reading, that's why membership to the, you know, with the Gazette and the Marine Corps Association, you know, and what I tend to do is when, you know, I'll be musing or think about something, or a battle or reading something. You know, I just ping over there and search on it. And you get this incredible narrative of the tactical level a lot, which I enjoy reading about. and the human drama. And then if you search Leatherneck as well, you get more human drama in that. I just, it's a treasure. It's a treasure, and I wanted to make a pitch for it, thinking about how much I've got out of it relative to Iwo Jima. Let's talk about this.
I'll put a bow on that a little bit. That is, it's appreciated. I really appreciate the opportunity to promote and talk up our archives. As I mentioned, that is a unique and valuable benefit of membership in the association. That's plus your monthly magazines is well worth the $42 a year. I would also point out that when it is the exception always proves the rule. So if there are educators or other academic researchers out there who are working on these subjects, don't hesitate to contact me personally. And if you need access or permissions regarding a specific article or groups of article, we're glad to support those efforts.
Awesome. Let's switch gears. February Gazette, what's it about?
Innovation. February is once again this year the innovation focused issue.
So it's February and March, right? Not just February. You can't do the Marine Corps is flipping itself over about three different ways. How do you do Marine Corps innovation in one volume?
Okay, great question. And one of the things that I'd point out is when I say we have a focus edition, that's not exclusive. So if you want to think about it as groups and scores on the paper target, center mass of a pretty good shot group is a set of articles about the theme for that month. But I still cover a MAGTAF waterfront in each issue. So in other words, there's other content that'll appear in the in this case, the innovation focus issue, and then articles on innovation will appear throughout the year, because there is that much of a push from the Commandant and other senior leaders on down to look at modernization, look at innovation, and be those disruptive thinkers that General Miller has called for. So. This is an innovation heavy focus in February, but every issue does look at innovation to one degree or another. March this year is actually going to be it's on the street electronically right now, out on the web, and March is a training education theme but still a few innovation articles as well.
All right, give me a couple articles in the February edition to about innovation, because as I said, from the turnover of just about every airframe in the Marine Corps to the revolution in infantry equipment, to the use of drones and other technology, to the modification of the squad, to different littoral platforms and missions and innovation there, where do you start and what would you recommend?
So let's take a little bit different tack, because this year's again innovation focus issue is a lot less about hardware, the gear side, whether it be new aircraft or new equipment of one variety or another, and more about innovative thinking, the ideas and the concepts that need to underpin our approach to future warfighting. So I'll make a couple of broad recommendations. There's one article by Colonel Cliff Weinstein and Lieutenant Colonel John Berry, retired, that is essentially looking at a new naval amphibious concept for the 21st century MAGTAF. I think from the perspective of the thinking side of innovation, that is a must read article. It very much could in some way serve as a foundation for a future amphibious doctrine, not unlike the tentative manual for landing operations of 1939 did. It looks at how we intend to fight in the littorals in an access denied environment with our Navy partners in the future. It looks at the command and control behind that. And again, if you get the ideas and the concept right, you've gone a long way to solving or overcoming the challenges before huge amounts of resources get spent on the hardware side. So I've got to plug that article. I've also got to plug a piece called Innovation Information Warfare by the Ellis Group, which really looks at innovative approaches to fighting in the, if you want to call it the fifth domain, but the information domain in the future. And so I think between those two, you've got two solid recommendations on approaching innovation from the thinking perspective at the service level.
When are information operations an act of war?
Wonderful question. I think that depends on who you talk to. but to be clear, that is very much a gray area, in the same sense, in some ways, that terrorist actions can be viewed by some as a law enforcement problem, vice an act of war. Again, it depends a little on who you talk to, and you'll get a different answer from the defense side, the military side, right, from the intelligence community, the law enforcement community, and an even further divergent view from industry. And in many cases, the information domain is wholly owned and operated by commercial industries around the world. How's that for a non-answer, Mac?
It's like, and then you hear Putin say, I don't know what people are talking about. Russia does not participate in these kind of operations. It is crazy. The American media has lost its mind. Got it.
Yes, exactly.
All right, give me one more.
Let me make one more recommendation.
And one off the digital only side.
Okay, give me 1 second. Hang on just 1 minute here.
Well, start talking and give me the other two, and then search for the one off the digital side.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. Let me hit you with again the idea behind it, and then there's several articles out there. If the first two I talked about were at almost the service strategic level,
right.
If you actually go a few levels down and start looking at what sort of innovative changes affect our frontline infantry, where the rubber meets the road, small ground combat units, specifically Marine infantry company, squad, battalion level units. There are a series of articles to include an introductory letter from our Brigadier General Alford, who is the former commander of the Warfighting Lab and is currently the Command General of Marine Corps Installations Command East. The overall theme behind these articles is that the most significant investment that the service could make to change the quality of training and experimentation for those tactical level infantry formations is to create a professional or standing opposing force. To have the structure and a dedicated unit that is effectively permanently charged with the mission of being the thinking enemy, both for tactical level training exercises and for some of our experimentation efforts. And so General Alford wrote an introductory letter on that, and then we have several other essays that that talk on that subject. So that'd be my my overall recommendation there.
Okay. All right, that
as
works.
Far as another batch of essays go.
No, that works. That works. All right. All right. What else?
The other thing I'll point out, you talk about online. So I'm going to recommend that there's an article out there online right now by Major Chad Buckle, B-U-C-K-E-L. And this is actually, he's written a series of articles for us. Some are appearing in print, some are appearing online, some are in both. But online you can find, well, for example, he's, we've got an article, in February on, improving small unit infantry training, that Major Buckle has written. We have an article, in print in, March, on, making an argument for a 15-man rifle squad. And then in appearing online only, is a third piece in his series that's essentially an argument for a formally defined infantry career path for both enlisted Marines and for infantry officers. You'll be seeing more of these articles in the coming months, going up through the May edition, which is actually going to be a dual focus, ground operations, ground combat element, and aviation. So we're going to have several more Major Buckles pieces in that edition.
Got it. Text message says there's a great article in Leatherneck magazine this month about traumatic brain injuries.
Absolutely, absolutely. The staff really did a great job with that. Went up to Bethesda Walter Reed. It did some interviews with the medical personnel, the staff who are working on the problem, and talked to a number of survivors, folks who are dealing with those injuries. It's a really fascinating article and very, very timely.
All right, Chris Woodbridge, the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette and the publisher of Leatherneck Magazine, along with being a retired infantry officer, a colonel, United States Marine Corps, part of the a retired piece of the Marine Corps Senate. Woody, have a great day. Thanks for the visit, and I apologize for being so late in the month.
No, not a problem, Mac, and look forward to the next one.
All right, bud. Take care. Thank you.
Roger, out here.
He is, again, let me just plug the Gazette archives one more time. I love reading those I accounts. Yeah. Slowly I stepped, step by step. Yeah. Really, really, very, very, very cool. They tended to be written, you know, not too long after the fight, which I like, cause they didn't have time to read, you know, 17 books or something like that before they wrote it. It's less scholarly and more, this is what I saw, which gives you some sense of what it was like. We're going to take a break. Michael Musselman going to join us next on a fast moving Tuesday here on, D plus one on Iwo Jima, the 20th day of February. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.